Okay, so now I'm going to be myself. This session is about healing and engaging. And what I'm going to explore is the issue of the power of bearing witness and the use of the personal narrative in print and film. I have no conflict of interest, but I will be using excerpts from a book I wrote, Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, and from a documentary movie that I produced that came out last week called Voices Across the Divide. I think the Israel-Palestine conflict presents us with unique psychological, moral, and political challenges. If you look at the context in which this conflict is occurring, we have centuries of Christian anti-Semitism and the Nazi Holocaust. We have indigenous Arab population with a small number of Jews living in historic Palestine for generations. Then we have the history of the colonial British Empire, United Nations partition. On top of that, there's the Zionist movement claiming historical Palestine as a Jewish homeland. And this is when we really established the precedent of Jewish exceptionalism and privilege over everybody else. So this is also a conflict between two very traumatized groups. It's a conflict over identity, religion, and land. And if that wasn't bad enough, then we have the global geopolitical impact. In the 50s, it was the Cold War, with Israel being the bulwark against the Soviet Union. Now we have a fight against terrorism. Then we throw in the transnational corporations, the big military-industrial complex between our army and the IDF, oil interests. It's a very complicated place. And then we have the way that the conflict is used by neighboring Arab states. We have the egregious policies of the Israeli government towards Palestinians in Israel, the occupied territories, and in neighboring countries. And then, not surprisingly, we have a history of Palestinian resistance, whether it's from horrific suicide bombing or to the nonviolent protests that are going on now. And then we put this in the international sphere, where there's fears of what I'm going to put in quotes, terrorism from the right-wing Islamic extremists, and rising Islamophobia in our world. And then there's a right-wing swing in Israeli society and what some people call the death of liberal Zionism. So what can we as healthcare providers offer into this morass? I think we have, as I said before, particular expertise in the bearing of witness to difficult and complex issues and the skills of empathic listening and critical observation. That's what we do in our offices every day. We can act as a bridge between opposing groups, whether it's a mother and her child or whether it's conflicted people on the political sphere. We can give voice to the invisible and the traumatized, and we have actually been trained to see each person as truly human. So I think we can create an opportunity to change stereotypes and to broaden the conversation and the possibilities for change. If we look at healing and engaging on the most interpersonal level, we're dealing with the issues of trauma, fear, hatred, racism, demonization of the other, and this is all occurring in a major power imbalance. The Israelis in this conflict are very powerful and the Palestinians are not. And there is a big challenge, the privileging from either the personal to the institutional and the acceptance of the narrative, language, version of history of one group, the powerful group, the Israelis, over another group. So how do we challenge prevailing narratives? And I just want to shape this. So the prevailing narrative, and this is the one that's in the mainstream in our country, is that after thousands of years, Jews who have been victims of anti-Semitism are returning to our homeland, where we have been met by inexplicably hostile, irrational Arabs who want to drive us into the sea. So as Rahama said, security is the number one priority. But I would like to propose a different narrative. Indigenous Arabs and a small number of Jews lived in historic Palestine, and the conflict really began when Jews began claiming their right to this place over everyone else who had ever been there, and there have been a lot of other groups who have been there. And this dispossession and violence and privileging continues to today. And the crux of the problem is that this narrative that we live in can only happen if we as human beings see Jews as more human, more deserving, more honorable than Arabs. If we as a community are blind to Arab suffering. So this becomes a fundamental issue of racism. And racism can potentially lead to ethnic cleansing and genocide. And I always like to think of the comment by Edward Said where he said, a people that does not tell its story leads to cultural genocide. So the importance of storytelling is paramount. So how can we change minds? And can literature and film do this? So I was sort of searching for examples, and I found this course at Boston College called The Film Representation of Genocide and Ethnic Cleansing. And in the syllabus it said, important films, especially about the Holocaust, have dominated the media over the past half century. And they talk about Schindler's List, The Pianist, Hotel Rwanda. And they say this course serves as a visual and historical witness to this scar on society's conscience. And the conflicts examined in this course, using historical texts, personal narratives, and film, it's taught by a professor, John Michalczyk, who's a filmmaker, and Reverend Raymond Helmick, who helped work on the Northern Ireland Accords, are the usual conflicts, Native Americans, Armenian Genocide, et cetera, but there's Israel-Palestine on this list. And many people are sort of shocked to find Israel-Palestine on that list. So I want to ask, why is that there? And the first thing is, if you look at the core assumption of political Zionism, the goal is maximum land with minimal Arabs. And if you look at the history, for instance, in 1948 with Plan Dalit, this was a plan for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. This was military instructions to get people to leave, to terrorize them, to burn down their villages, et cetera, et cetera. And in 67 with the occupied territories, there's been a massive growth of Jewish settlements, again, privileging Jewish needs over non-Jewish needs. And in Israel, we see the institutional privileging of Jews over non-Jews, so that when I travel there, it seems like in Israel there's some kind of Jim Crow, and in the occupied territories, some form of apartheid. And then this really impacts our understanding, this kind of framing on U.S. policies at home. And there's a lot of blindness to this conversation. So as an example, in academia, next June in Jerusalem, there is a conference called the International Oral History Conference, organized by Hebrew University with, you know, famous historians, etc. And the conference is focusing on trauma studies, Holocaust studies, conflict studies. But they are not touching any reference to the Nakba, which is the Palestinian experience of what happened in 1948. And there was an interesting analysis in Counterpunch where they said that the fact that Hebrew University is avoiding the Nakba is because of its own complicity in the ongoing Palestinian trauma. And there was recently a law passed in Israel that bans the commemoration or teaching of the Nakba, the Palestinian experience. So this means that a Palestinian with Israeli citizenship in an Israeli school, in their little segregated Arab school, is learning Zionist history. So this avoidance is part of a larger project of Israeli denial. And if you look back at history, Israel often refuses to grant Palestinian universities the license to operate or closes them under certain periods. And during these times, not once did Israeli faculty, Israeli educational institutions ever call for the reopening of Palestinian universities or the restitution of academic freedom. So Israeli universities are directly complicit in Israel's violations of Palestinian rights. And they've also collaborated with the military occupation. There are huge research institutes in Israeli universities helping the military-industrial complex. And with the Hebrew University, they expanded their campus into illegally occupied and confiscated land. So if we look at the issue of social psychology, how do people get to the point where they can kill and hate each other? There are certain things that are important to be in place. One is a culture of authority and obedience, which supplants individual morality and responsibility. And I think of the soldiers, the Jewish soldiers in Breaking the Silence, who wake up to their sense of individual morality and speak out against what they have done in the IDF. You need to have loyalty to a large mission that loosens moral inhibitions. This would be Jewish privilege and the sense of permanent Jewish victimization, which allows Jews to do whatever they need to survive. Then you have the routinization of violence, which is well documented in the Israeli Defense Force, and then underlying injustice, economic hard times, etc. But the critical ingredient is the dehumanization of victims. And if we turn to psychiatry, and for instance, the work of Judith Herman, she talks about the psychological trauma, that psychological trauma is an affliction of the powerless, so that the moment of trauma, the victim is rendered helpless, and that sharing the traumatic experience with others is part of the restitution of creating a meaningful world. So recovery unfolds in three stages: the establishment of safety, the remembrance and mourning, and the reconnection with ordinary life. So how do political realities, whether it's anti-Semitism or it's the Israeli governmental and military policy or Nakba denial, impair this recovery? So let's look at how print and film can help that. In print and film, we are able to change framing, language, and historical assumptions. For instance, we can look at the impact of the occupation. Is it about military security, or is it about control and humiliation of Palestinians and Israeli land acquisition? We can look in a very personal way at what is the impact on the civilian population on education, healthcare, economy, sense of hope. So I'm going to do a little thought experiment with y'all. I'm going to, first of all, list some facts about the 67 war. You know, Egypt was blocking the Straits of Tehran. There were all sorts of things going on. Then Israel launched an attack and captured the West Bank, Gaza Strip, Syrian Golan Heights, East Jerusalem, the Sinai Peninsula. This is factually what happened. 200,000 to 400,000 Palestinians were dispossessed. The UN responded saying, don't do that. We know this. But does this move your heart and soul? And I want you to compare how that feels with listening to someone who actually experienced the 67 war. And this is from my movie, and if there is a God, this will play. So.
The story of the Nakba was a story for my sisters and I from 1967. It was my grandfather's story, it was my mother's story, it was a trauma. But, you know, when you're a child, you don't understand it. So in 1967, it stopped being a story. Israel struck Egypt, and it was war.
So in 1967, you're in Ramallah.
I'm in Ramallah.
You're how old?
10 years old.
You go to Catholic school.
Catholic school, life is wonderful. There's nothing wrong. And all of a sudden, I would call it a transformation from childhood to hell. Our house became a shelter because we had a basement. So we have 30 neighbors sitting in a small place, listening to a small transistor radio. No electricity whatsoever. Everybody gathered their food, but the grown-up basically knew that we need to ration. And after 3 or 4 days, the ration became, you know, less and less. But, you know, I'm 10 years old, nothing bothered me in here except you're sitting there and said, you look at the fear. After the 6th day, you hear soldiers in Arabic saying, war is over, you could come out and you could have the white flag. You go out there and it was Israeli armies and soldiers that spoke Arabic. You see the panic on the family and you know it was not an Arab army.
June 5th was the beginning of the war, and that was a Monday. Wednesday was the day that Mavis was there. It was very scary that they would come at night in the tents and in the jeeps and all of that, and sirens. It'd be like 2 in the morning, they would get the sirens going until about 5 in the morning. So time and then what? We had no shelters. There's nothing. And we had to find a place in the house that was the safest, so we sat all in one corridor. And then we had to have a lecture from my father about what will happen if we separate. Because there was this fear about taking prisoners, raping women. But all of that dimmed compared to the idea of we are going to be kicked out. So go put whatever you need to take with you together because we're going to be kicked out. And I think that's the fear of the Palestinians. So I remember my father coming to us and basically handing us the little money that we had, some jewelry, and we all agreed that if we separate it, and if we take that, where we're going to be.
Israel was putting what they call...
Okay, do you want to turn on the lights so I can see what I'm doing
so
here?
So do you believe in God now?
I'm almost not secular, almost. And I want to give you another example from writing. So we have all these facts about occupation. There are all these checkpoints, there's permitting systems, there's separation wall. You know, half of Gazans are children. We intellectually know all of this material. But think about or tune into your feelings about how this feels and what you understand about occupation when you hear some personal narrative. And I just want to give an example from literature, being my literature. And I'm going to talk about an experience that I had with Dr. Khadija Jarrah, who's actually Alam Jarrah's wife. And she's the head of women's healthcare at Palestinian Medical Relief Society. And we were traveling between a USAID-funded maternity center in Maifaloon to the Ministry of Health Hospital in Jenin, and we're talking. And this is our conversation. We had just toured the hospital, and we're told that women are discharged 2 hours after delivery with no home visit. After visiting the wards crowded with tired looking women and their families, and now riding this rutted road, the brutality of the political and medical reality is suddenly revealed to me with a glaring new clarity. I ask, a woman's at the maternity center. She's low risk. She develops high blood pressure. She has to be transferred in a rush to the hospital. She has to be taken on this gutted, bumpy, irregular, ridiculous road to get to the hospital while she's having a contraction every 3 minutes and seizing or whatever horrible thing is happening? Khadija responds patiently, yes, of course. And if the woman delivers at the Ministry of Health Hospital, she's discharged 2 hours later. How does she get home, I ask again. Khadija responds, in the usual times they take the taxi and they go, if their village is not blocked. If not, they have to reach the blockage and then they have to walk. I think I'm starting to understand. So you could be 3 hours postpartum with fresh sutures and your breasts are full and you're exhausted and anemic and you have a brand new baby who's screaming and you could be waiting at a checkpoint and walking hundreds of meters between checkpoints? Khadija nods emphatically. That's right. This is the reality. You have to walk through the checkpoints. Sometimes you have to walk maybe 500 meters or more if there's not a mountain which was made by the soldier and walk through it. I know a woman from Ramallah who gave birth for a premature baby, and they didn't allow her to stay with the baby at the hospital. She stayed for 2 days. The baby had to stay more in the incubator, and they sent her home. Then she wanted to come pick up the baby after 1 week of delivery. She has to wait. It was winter. She has to wait on the checkpoints for 3 hours. And when she reached the hospital, she sat on the chair, and they found her dead on the chair. I wonder aloud if she died of infection, high blood pressure, anemia, or maybe just plain heartbreak. Khadija responds, it doesn't matter. It was because of the Israeli actions. Whatever it was, whatever, she died because of the situation. Poor woman, she couldn't complain. And even if she complained, so who would listen to her? And I just want to do one more quote that I have but from Nurit Peled Elhanan, whose daughter Smadari was killed by a suicide bomber in 1997. And she's speaking at an International Women's Day in Strasbourg at the European Parliament. Living in the world I live in the state I live in the regime I live in, I don't dare to offer Muslim women any ideas how to change their lives. I don't want them to take off their scarves or educate their children differently, and I will not urge them to constitute democracies in the image of Western democracies that despise them and their kind. I just want to ask them humbly to be my sisters, to express my admiration for their perseverance and for their courage to carry on, to have children, and to maintain a dignified family life in spite of the impossible conditions my world is putting on them. I want to tell them we are all bounded by the same pain. We are all the victims of the same sort of violence, even though they suffer much more, for they are the ones who are mistreated by my government and its army, sponsored by my taxes. And I'm just going to end with one quote from an Israeli historian. He said, "The most important thing I have learned is that after all is said and done, remembering and acknowledging victims that we ourselves create is much more effective in bringing about human reconciliation and the living of an ethical life than incessantly recalling that we are the descendants of people who were once victimized by others." Thank you. So we have time for questions. Please say your name and keep these as questions of like a minute so we can all respond. Sir.
Kelly Richter, Doctor at Hebrew University in Dusk, Jerusalem. Paul and I go back a long, long way. I hope you stop smoking. Very, very active, 1980s. Field visits on behalf of PHR, problems with tear gas, prison conditions, toxic waste dumps, and veterans. Expert witness in the 1990s on a PHR case on exposure to Roundup in the Bedouin villages in the Negev. And I have to say to you, Dr. Rothschild, your paper reminds me of a line Mary McCarthy said about Lillian Hellman. She said the only true words Lillian Hellman ever wrote for anything she wrote were the words and the, and she wasn't even sure about that. I could go through point by point all the statements you made and issue my reputation. In fact,
could you ask a question? Yeah. Could you ask a question, sir?
Okay. In fact, I have circulated to the members, all the people to whom Dr. Kropian has written a monograph pointing out point by point refutations of just about every statement made in that.
This is a discussion, so I need a question that one of us can answer.
Now, my question. PHR was totally silent in the 8 years of bombing. that every organization has since recognized is a crime against humanity. Yet you were silent. And that asymmetry was just one of the many examples.
Sir, I need you to ask a question that we can answer.
Why were you silent in those 8 years?
Thank you. But other people need to have a chance. Rahama?
I think 1 minute is just not fair to deal with a litany of lies.
I want to remind us that we're here to share and not to convince,
yes.
And that we do not have to agree with each other, but we do have to be civil.
Certainly.
Rahama, do you want to?
No. Next question.
Okay. Next question. Sir.
I'm listening to the political information that you're imparting. I'm not really hearing anything about medicine and about how it reaches across the divide. And I failed to hear all the information about Arab children being cared for in Israeli hospitals, about all of the destruction of the Israeli society done by the Arabs. So what is the purpose of this one-sided litany of lies, as the gentleman had said, that you're imparting to people who may not know the truth? I think you may know the truth, and you know that you're lying. Why are you lying?
So, first of all, I do not think I'm lying. Second of all, I am presenting my experiences traveling in Israel, traveling in the West Bank, reading a tremendous amount of literature, talking to physicians, working with families, and it is clear to me that Israelis are certainly traumatized by what's going on, okay? But it is also clear to me that there's a huge amount of trauma going on in the occupied territories that is related to the political situation that is not known. And I feel that it's my responsibility to make known that which is invisible and that which most of people in this country either fail to know or fail to see. And I see that as my responsibility. And I in no way think I am lying. I really am very, very clear on that.
Yeah. So now you know, as president of the synagogue, why there are these very, very different forces, both of whom believe in those truths, you know, and I think that in a way is very important to highlight, because everybody believes, you know, again, and I have total respect for what Alice is saying, and I have respect for, you know, for both what you are doing, and I think at the end of the day, I believe, as I've already indicated, that we should try to thread the needle, and try to have as civil a conversation as possible. Try to document facts as much as we can, because obviously facts are in the eyes of the beholder too. I understand that, but also and that's what we try to do. Again, understanding the limitations of all these different groups is trying to improve on the ground, at a minimum, in a demonstrable way, the health of the people who are being impacted, both in Israel and in the West Bank. And to see if these community-based groups can increase their capacity to deal with the conflict. But what you do see, frankly, is the dramatic, you know, disparity, gulf that exists. And that's I would invite all of you to kind of get engaged in whichever way you feel is appropriate, but not get too dispirited at all.
I'll say a few words. So I think that if we look at, I'm a sort of on and off member of APHA, so I don't 100%, I can't 100% address that problem, but I know that APHA addresses many issues in the world. and many injustices in the world, and many disadvantaged and traumatized populations in the world. And I would ask that when we look at this particular issue, that we treat it like any other traumatized population, and that we be very tuned in to all the buttons that get pushed, and what I would say is misinformation that happens, and that we really try to be aware of the kind of racism that we have in our own society and in our own hearts, the kind of fear that Jews carry with themselves, and the sense of victimization that makes it virtually impossible to have these conversations, and that we really try to normalize this conversation, because if we can't talk about it like any other conversation, we're just going to get stuck, I think. And so I think that's the first step. Do you want to say something? And Marcia, do you want to say something, or do you want to ask a question? Okay, so.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Just real briefly, I've already indicated to you that I don't believe that the resolution is a good resolution only because of the fact that it encourages divestment, which I think is a political position in the United States that's not going to work. And I may or may not be supportive of it, but the reality is it's just not going to politically work. What I do say can work, and I think is very important to highlight, is that APHA and people like many of you in the room can provide significant advice on issues of nonviolent protest. I think that has been adopted to an extent in the West Bank, but has not been adopted on a massive scale. If it was adopted on a massive scale, I think that could make an impact. Thirdly, I would just say that the work that we do, both in Israel and the West Bank, is working with community-based groups. The website is, I think, on the proposal that was the abstract, and we welcome your engagement.
And I also would just like to add, sort of as a counterpoint, that I do support the resolution C7, and I think that there are many, many important points in the list, and the last one addressing the issue of socially responsible occupation-free investing is a critical one. And I seriously believe that the boycott, divestment, sanction movement is the most powerful, most creative, nonviolent resistance movement that is ongoing in the world at this point. And that Palestinian civil society activists have asked us to do this as an international community. It's very powerful in Europe. It's impacting many churches in the United States, and it's impacting Jewish groups such as Jewish Voice for Peace. There are companies that are starting to feel the pressure, and I think that we've shown that it works in other situations of apartheid, and I think that it will work in this one. So I would just offer a counter comment. But there are other questions.
I would like to make a factual point, okay, which is important. Whatever you think about the BDS movement, I believe that C7 does not align itself with BDS. It's not about divestment from Israel. It asks a much narrower thing, which is that there should be established in investment opportunities that are free from companies that profit from the occupation. That's a really important point, because you shouldn't be for or against this because you're for or against BDS, because you're for or against divestment from Israeli companies or Israel. For or against should hinge on what this policy actually says. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that.
We've heard a lot about social determinants of health at this meeting. We've heard the big opening session. So I was hoping you could share with us from your experiences what you think going on in the occupied territories that actually diminish the issues of education and economic ability and gender issues that also sort of, I think, diminish the health of that area. You know, give us more information.
Thank you. I know that the occupation for 46 years became a kind of normalized process which serves the segregation and the apartheid. You should know about apartheid, Ellie. And
you should know about
don't disturb me, please. Thank you. don't disturb me, thank you. And many aggressive people would like to see that aggressiveness should not be on the weak part, but state terrorism, state aggressiveness is okay. Why don't you ask the Israeli army not to invade Gaza Strip whenever it pleases, or any other place in the West Bank, village or city or town, and arrest people, kill people, torture people? This is okay. Only their demonstrations, their way of saying we don't like it, that should be in a quiet, nice way? Well, this is an open question. And to put a demand on the weak part, which is the Palestinians, to be non-violent demonstrations. What about the other side? I mean, people who demand so aggressively that kind of symmetry, please think about it. And the segregation and apartheid process is reducing the possibility of every segment of life in the occupied territory. If it is, I mean, first of all, economy, which serves all the rest of aspects of life. They cannot do anything. Forget about export, forget about import, forget about creating industry, even small industry. They cannot do it. So what they can do, they can cut the lemon trees in Gaza and fire them because they cannot export it, and so on and so forth. And if there is no economy, there is no money for education, there is no money for health system, not to mention, as Alice said it so very well, that the health services are scattered. There is no one center. There is no one ministry of health. I mean, the ministry exists, but the system doesn't exist, because they need to create little centers everywhere, which is wasting of money, wasting of energy, and it can never serve as good as one good center.